Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. In the interviews for the Middle Way Society, when appropriate, I generally ask people what their understanding is of the Middle Way and how it might relate to what they've been talking about. This is the first compilation of interviewees' responses to those questions. Vidya Mala-Birch, the co-founder of Breathworks and the author of Mindfulness for Health, spoke about her life and work, and I asked her how she thought mindfulness practices related to the Middle Way.
Well, I think with mindfulness practice, if you're sitting to meditate every day, or you're lying on your bed doing a body scan or whatever it is, you're going to become more aware. That's what's going to happen, because that's what mindfulness practice is. You're going to become more aware of your body, more aware of your thoughts, and more aware of your emotions. It might be that initially you just become aware that you're really tense.
Yeah.
You feel really blocked or very resistant, whatever it is. But that is awareness dawning. And that means you will become more integrated, and you'll become a person who's, as you bring more stuff into awareness, you can then process it, and you can then integrate it within your psyche, within your consciousness. And that means you're no longer going to be a person who's so polarized within yourself.
Yeah.
And then that means you'll be a person who's less polarized with the world around you. And I think we can call this integration, and you can look at it both on what we could call a horizontal and vertical level. The horizontal is where you become more aware of different aspects of your conscious mind.
Yeah. Okay.
So you might become aware of your thoughts, and you realize that you have thoughts of anger that maybe you weren't really even that aware of before.
Yeah.
And being aware of an angry thought is very different from being lost in an angry thought.
Okay, yeah.
You say, wow, that's an angry thought, as opposed to, I hate that person.
Yeah.
That's quite a shift.
There is a difference there, definitely.
Yeah. And then I think the vertical integration is more where you become aware of what's in your unconscious. It kind of bubbles up, or your subconscious, it bubbles up into your conscious mind. And you can also become aware of sort of higher states of mind, you know, at times when you're feeling very clear, happy, loving, yeah, and so on. So I think mindfulness is by its nature very integrating.
Okay. Yeah.
Particularly when it's combined with these loving kindness and compassion practices.
Yeah.
And that means you're going to become a less conflicted person internally and with the world around you, which is more of a middle way approach, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Given that you teach mindfulness practices beyond the Buddhist tradition, what do you think of the idea of the middle way as a whole being taught beyond the Buddhist tradition?
Well, again, as I've been saying earlier on, I'm a tremendous pragmatist. So I think if the middle way is a method where people can sort of grow and develop as human beings, take their place in humanity within a skillful and generous and loving way, then wonderful. The world is desperate for ways to bring harmony. You know, the world's in a terrible state, isn't it? So the world is desperate for anything that's going to enable people to become more whole, more integrated, more positive, less conflicted, you know, conflicted both within themselves and with the world around them. And if the middle way is one way of doing that, then I think wonderful, you know. I think my philosophy, and it is really very simple, is if it works, do it. That will be the litmus test. Does it work?
Julian Adkins, a CBT therapist from Edinburgh, spoke about his time as a ballet dancer and engineer, why he joined the society, his experiences with the Christian, Buddhist and atheist traditions, and I asked him what the middle way and integration meant to him.
Well, of course, I mean, I first came across the idea of the middle way in Buddhism, and I think probably in common with a lot of people, my initial impression of this idea was simply that it's some kind of notion of temperance, you know, that you don't go to the extremes of asceticism on the one hand, but going to the extremes of self-indulgence and a certain kind of hedonism at the other end of the spectrum is equally unhelpful. So, but obviously I've come to understand it in a much wider way, a much deeper way, as time has gone on, as being a middle way between, well, I suppose in the classical framework, a middle way between certain eternalistic metaphysical perspectives and nihilistic metaphysical perspectives. But I mean, any kind of metaphysical opposites could stand in for those too. So just basically trying to sort of put these questions about what happens after we die and what's the ultimate nature of reality and such like on one side, and engage with experience as we find it in a more kind of pragmatic way. So I think it's got much in common with various sort of pragmatic philosophical traditions.
Okay, and what about this notion of integration as part of middle way philosophy? What are your thoughts on that?
I find it a very helpful idea. Rather than demonizing certain desires that we have, recognizing that desires are just desires, and you know, we have them, and desires are complex. They are, my understanding of desire is that it's got different components. It's got cognitive as well as affective components. How we feel about things is very intimately linked with how we think about things and what we believe. And I guess this fits very much with my experience as a cognitive behavioral therapist as well, bringing these ideas together in a way that they're working together. So how can we meet our human needs in the most holistic way, so that we're not trying to suppress anything, basically. Yeah.
Ian McGilchrist, the patron of the society, spoke about his book, The Master and His Emissary, The Value of the Arts, his views on awe, modernity and religion, and I asked him how he felt his work related to the middle way.
Well, I was very struck when I encountered Robert Ellis's work, and I did think that there were enormous overlaps there. I'm currently writing a book about the sort of rather paradoxical things that keep happening to us, if you like to see it that way. In other words, we think we're doing the right thing and setting about things, but because we've got a very simply polarized view that it's either this or it's that, we tend to end up with conclusions or in places which we never intended.
Yeah.
And so, I think a rather important point is that I don't think that whatever the middle way is, it's simply an average, as it were, or a sort of midpoint on a linear scale. You have to think in a non-linear way, as it being almost like something that's at right angles to the way we normally think.
Mm.
In other words, that might involve going in both directions, opposed as they might be, equally far, rather than sort of settling for, it doesn't mean a compromise. Although sometimes a compromise is a very mature, wise and sane thing.
Stephen Batchelor, the Buddhist author and teacher, spoke about his interest in photography and collage, how he sees art as an integrative practice, and I asked him how he felt it related to the middle way.
This is where it gets a little bit tricky without actually being able to show you the work itself. But collage, I don't just sort of cut pieces of paper up and bits of card and bits of plastic and then just sort of glue them willy-nilly onto a piece of card. I follow a very, very formulaic principles of organization of the material. And that brings into play a tension between between chance and order, or randomness and order. In other words, the materials are random. They're not things I buy or go out to get. They're things I find. There's the element of chance there.
Yeah.
It's just what I'll stumble across. But there's very much an element of order and control in the way that these found objects are arranged. And they're arranged on grid patterns, a bit like mosaics, and they're cut in particular ways that follow certain, I suppose, if I were a mathematician, there's probably some algorithms at work somewhere, but I don't think mathematically. I find that the organizing structures of my work actually come to me as I'm thinking in pictures. I know that might sound strange, but many of the key moves in the development of my collage art have come to me almost as sort of epiphanies I've seen in my mind, you know, where the thing is going next. And it's very difficult to describe what's going on there. But that's, in a sense, the sort of dynamic, the element of chance, which seems to trigger and perpetuate a particular sense of structure and order. Now, part of that structure, and so I'm getting to your point, don't worry, part of that structure has to do with a rather firm insistence on the principle of identity and difference. In other words, one of my rules is I never put two pieces of material together. I never let two pieces of material that are identical touch. So let's give me an example. I have a large work about 70 centimeters square, composed of about 1,024 white squares.
Yeah.
And those 1,024 white squares are cut-ups of 81 pieces of found white paper. Now, when you're walking down the street and you see a piece of white paper, you just say, oh, there's a piece of white paper. Oh, there's another piece of white paper. Oh, there's another piece of white paper. And you get them all together. And when you start putting them side by side, you realize that none of them are the same. In other words, they somehow illuminate the tension between things we would conventionally say, oh, that and that, they're the same, they're both white.
Mm.
And yet when you put them next to each other, you realize, well, actually, they're not the same, they're different.
Yeah.
They're both the same and different, in other words. So what I'm playing with is this sameness and difference. Now, this is, of course, a key argument in Madhyamaka philosophy, that things do not have inherent existence because they are not identical or different from other things. The categories of identity and difference are incapable of capturing the contingency, the fluidity, the emergence and the unfolding of life itself. So at some level, although this might sound terribly abstract, I'm trying to somehow play with the tension between identity and difference that somehow helps reveal the world as not reducible to our classical, linguistic categories, such as those of identity and difference. And that, of course, is the way of looking at shunyata, which is, of course, the middle way.
Society member Peter Goebel spoke about his career in nursing, working in Africa and being a prison Buddhist chaplain. I asked him what his thoughts were on the universality of the middle way, given that many people interested in the society have no connection with Buddhism.
Well, I think that's right. That's important. I think that Buddhism as it's expressed, as it's sold, as it's advertised to the West and in the West, and as it's developed in the West, is a blind alley. It's a blind alley. It's another ism. You know, it's another lifestyle choice. I'm not disrespecting people who are sincere about it, but my experience of the various Buddhists and various sanghas is it's very superficial. You know, there isn't a real engagement with the work that needs to be done, the work that we need to do. You know, the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, expressed to his generation, to his people in his time, in a way that they understood. But there's nothing around that meets our contemporary needs, but the middle way society supplies it.
Tai Chi instructor John Bolwell gave an overview in the interview of this popular martial art. I then asked him whether he saw a connection between the Taoist basis of Tai Chi, Yin Yang, etc., and with how he understood the middle way.
Yes, I think the yin yang, if you like, the two extremes,
yeah,
the sort of the male, the female, the light, the dark, but in the yin yang symbol, they revolve around each other, which symbolises a dynamic interplay, yeah, of the two. So this sort of never is anything completely yin or completely yang. So in the double fish that you often see in the yin yang symbol, in the black part there's a little white dot, which means in the yin, even within the yin at its most extreme, it can revert to its opposite, the right. Yang, and within the yang, the white, there's a black dot. So one thing is always interplaying with another. And yeah, again, this might be on a personal level. If someone is very yang, can they discover and find more softer parts of the personality, yeah, and the body? And if someone is very yin or perhaps a low energy, can they be invigorated with more sort of yang energy? Yeah. Or if someone's very feminine, can they find other aspects of the personality? So the practice is something that may help to encourage and become a more rounded person,
mm-hmm,
which I think is the middle way, really, rather than being one extreme,
yeah,
the yin or the yang.
In this member profile, Emily Orbai spoke about her life, why she's studying psychology, agnosticism, and her plan to be a horticultural therapist. I asked her what the middle way meant to her and her views on integration.
I hope that integration is something that most people can achieve. It's probably not as high up on the sort of steps, you know, the Maslow step of, you know, basic needs. And I don't think it's as high up as maybe it's sometimes seen as, you know, like a luxury. I don't think it necessarily has to be. But the middle way perhaps can give you some tools to further integration without buying into some of the things that, you know, a lot of religion and ideology overall, I don't think it's specific to religion, it's ideology as I see it. Mm-hmm. You buy a bundle of ideas, and then to get the one that says something to you, you have to buy all these things that come with it, and then they confuse you, you know, because you adapt them even though they don't really make any intuitive sense, or they're not based on your experience. So it's like taking one step forward and two steps back, and having some kind of framework to try and decide what makes sense to you and what is just noise.
Yeah,
it's a valuable contribution. So I think that's what appealed to me with the middle way.
Yeah, presumably you see integration when you talk about achieving it as not in an ultimate way, but something that you can work towards.
Yeah, more of a process that, I mean, obviously it's not, I don't think it's like a nirvana state. I think it's I think that as people we kind of make our reality continuously, and we make our own selves that exist in this reality, and it's an ongoing process, and you have to always sort of, you accumulate a lot of stuff that you need to integrate.
Yeah.
So it's never going to be done, I don't think.
Retired art teacher Norma Smith spoke about why she became a member of the society, the importance of art in her life, agnosticism, and the power of metaphor. I asked her whether she'd always had an intuitive sense of the middle way.
I think so, yes, I think so, but you know, lots of people I can think of as leading a middle way, but it does need a certain amount of effort to work things through.
Yeah.
You know. And I'm happy to do that because I love to learn.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.